Mangroves in Australia cover an area of about 12,000 square kilometres, an area as large as some of our largest inland stations. In tropical areas, since people tend to live on the coastal fringe, the mangrove, with its unusual root system and its feet always in the mud, is one of the most commonly recognised plants. It is, however, in its role as part of the life cycle, which sees it provide protection to prawn hatcheries and barramundi, that its use as a resource is apparent. The Australian Institute of Marine Science, situated on the North Queensland coast, has come a long way since it first decided to establish permanent study sites on Hinchinbrook Island, north of Ingham. Today, apart from the work that is continuing in the Hinchinbrook area, studies are being carried out right across the top end of Australia. In fact, the Australian research has become recognised right throughout Asia and Oceania, so much so that requests for assistance in setting up research and management programs have become quite common. Why then is such a fuss being made over mangroves? For one thing, a mangrove thrives in a very aggressive environment. Its roots sit in almost permanently waterlogged soil. Its water supply is almost totally salt water, and yet it continues to survive. Part of the work on this ability to survive has been carried out at the Institute by Dr. Barry Clough. Not only has he been looking at the ability of the mangroves to take up salt and dispose of it, but he's been looking at the effect of climate on the mangrove with some surprising results.
Does the high rainfall have a marked effect on mangrove growth?
Yes, it does, in one sense, that under periods of high rainfall, the salinity of the substrate on which the mangroves grow is much reduced. However, that, I think, is probably only an auxiliary effect and is limited to certain periods of the year when you do get very, very high and intense periods of rain. I think the other factor, which is probably more important in determining the growth and luxuriant of mangroves, at least as far as the climate is concerned, and particularly in relation to rainfall, is the fact that rainfall is normally associated with cloudy conditions, and a combination of cloudy conditions lead to a combination of factors which are probably advantageous for the growth of mangroves. These include the fact that under cloudy conditions, the leaves receive less intense sunlight and therefore don't get quite as hot. And secondly, the fact that the humidity under cloudy conditions tends to be somewhat higher than under conditions of bright sunlight. Now, these two factors together essentially determine the rate at which mangroves lose water, and to a large degree also the rate at which mangroves take up salt, because salt uptake to the leaves, or at least salt transport to the leaves, and water uptake and loss from the leaves are very closely associated with each other. The reason that these two processes are linked so closely together is because the rate of water loss from a leaf is determined to a large degree by how widely open the stomata are, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the difference in vapor pressure between the leaf and the air. Now, obviously, under conditions of high humidity, the difference in vapor pressure between leaf and air will be relatively small, whereas under conditions of where the humidity is fairly low, the difference between the leaf and the air will be quite large, so that this will tend to cause water to evaporate much more rapidly from the leaf under dry conditions.
Looking at the point that you're making about photosynthesis, you're saying that under cloudy conditions the plant's better off because of the higher humidity. What about photosynthesis under this cloudy condition?
Well, there's also a link between photosynthesis and water loss, in as much as photosynthetic carbon uptake also is dependent very much on how widely open the stomata are. So under conditions where the stomata are closed, not only is water loss from the leaf somewhat reduced, but also photosynthetic carbon uptake is similarly reduced. So that in that sense there's a very close link also between photosynthetic carbon uptake and water loss. Now, all of these factors can be put together into some general concept of a model about the way in which mangroves regulate their carbon uptake, salt uptake and water loss in relation to the environment and in particular to climatic factors. Now, under conditions where the climate is very dry, where there's no cloud, the leaves get very hot, the relative humidity of the atmosphere is quite low, and the situation then is that the leaves lose a lot of water fairly quickly, much faster in fact than the plants can take up water through the roots. They suffer fairly severe water stress or water deficit, and as a consequence of that the stomata tend to close. Now of course this reduces photosynthesis at the same time. By comparison, under conditions where the climate leads to periods of prolonged rain or prolonged periods of cloudiness, the situation is more or less the reverse, in that because the leaves are not so hot and because the humidity is higher, less water is lost, and the stomata close to a less the stomata remain open for longer periods during the daytime, and of course carbon assimilation then is maintained at a fairly high level. Now of course photosynthesis also depends very much on the amount of light available, but because mangroves photosynthesis in mangroves doesn't respond to light levels much above between half and two-thirds full sunlight, periods of prolonged cloudiness are unlikely to reduce photosynthesis very much because of a lack of light.
What is the big problem with water anyway? Most mangroves that you do see along the coast are physically standing in it.
Well, the big problem with the water in which mangroves stand, while it's true that they have plenty of water in a physical sense, is the fact that the water is so saline. And this means that they have to generate very, very substantial negative suctions inside them in order to get the water out of the soil. This means that they effectively living under conditions which for most other plants would be considered to be severe drought conditions, and in that sense they probably are paralleled only by many of the more extreme xerophytic plants living in desert areas.
Plant ecophysiologist Dr. Barry Clough. In looking at mangrove research, it's easy to see that often the basic facts are hidden behind the necessities of technical and scientific description. Barry Clough's work is based around the growth of the mangrove. It may be an oversimplification, but his work has shown that the mangrove will grow better in the wet tropical areas because of high humidity and more overcast conditions in the wet season. In the drier tropics, where cloudy days are less common and the humidity is less, the trees do not grow as well. So much for the trees themselves. As part of the life cycle in north coastal areas, the mangrove creates an important resource. Tropical waters are low in nutrient, and so it was no surprise that the mangrove grows in phosphate-deficient soils, a system most farmers in Australia would understand. Certainly there is no evidence that farm fertilisers are entering river systems to harm mangrove forests. A major input from the mangroves is in litter. This falls from the trees and forms perhaps the most basic unit of the life chain, the microorganism. Among the biologists, ecophysiologists and botanists at the Australian Institute of Marine Science is Frank Gillam, an analytical chemist, working on methods to check the start of a life chain.
What is happening is the mangrove leaf material is being exported to the coastal zone sediments, etc., and parts of that leaf material are staying around. A large part of the leaf material is in fact being degraded. Now, from that, we get the impression that a large portion of the carbon is input into the coastal system. There are a series of questions here. The first one is, does it just return as carbon dioxide, or does it in fact become part of, for example, bacterial populations in these surface sediments, which are subsequently food sources for prawns and other benthic invertebrates, or is it directly cycled into some other form that, that doesn't in fact influence the food chains? Now, my research initially is looking at what part of the mangrove leaf material that is exported into these coastal environments in fact remains around. The parts of the leaf, for example the lignin, are relatively stable. They are not readily utilised by bacteria, so that we can follow the lignin out in the sediments and get an estimate of the amount of mangrove material that by difference is being input in some fashion into the system. The other aspect of my work is to take mangrove leaves, for example, in a laboratory simulation and study the colonization of those mangrove leaves by bacteria and fungi and the utilization by these organisms of parts of the leaf as a food source, so that we can get a quantitative relationship between the productivity of the mangrove system and the amount of bacterial, fungal and protozoan biomass that can be produced by that net productivity. Now, this is only the beginning of an overall project on the importance of the mangrove ecosystem to our coastal zone food resources. Later on, probably many years hence, on because of the amount of detailed background work involved, we will be able to look at the food chain steps from, for example, the bacteria to mollusks and other benthic invertebrates. And a further step after that is to look at the importance to the fish resource of the coastal zone.
Would you say, therefore, that most of the research in this area has been more of a qualitative nature? In other words, saying that we know the mangroves are important in a step of the food chain. Can we now be expecting research to be looking at the quantitative nature? In other words, if we've got so much mangroves, we know this is going to produce so much food to a food chain, and the eventual result is going to be so much fish or prawns or barramundi or whatever.
That would ultimately be the goal, though at present we can definitely say the mangroves do fix carbon. That carbon must go somewhere. We have a large coastal zone food resource. It's most likely that it is controlling that. It would obviously be optimal if we could start getting an idea of the factors controlling that input of mangrove material into this coastal zone food resource, and thus be able to predict the effect of perturbations of that environment, either by clearing of the mangrove forests, pollution, or any other effect on our fish, prawn, etc. productivity. So that hopefully the work I'm doing will eventually lead to a predictive model, and that's the primary aim of it, a quantitative predictive model of the effect of mangrove productivity on coastal zone food resource levels.
So where to for mangroves and mangrove research? In-depth studies into the mangrove's growth and factors affecting it, and studies into its place as a resource in the food chain are continuing. But where will it lead? The director of the Australian Institute of Marine Science, Dr. John Bunt, says that compared to many other countries in the world, Australia takes little notice of the mangrove. While in Australia the mangrove is looked at basically by ecologists as a fish hatchery or marine ecosystem, in many other countries it's viewed as an essential part of a wood chip or lumber industry, or indeed as a place for people to live. While this last option seems odd to many of our thoughts, the Hinchinbrook experiment with its walkways through the mangrove forest has already attracted large numbers of tourists to a unique botanical and biological area. And for the long term, Dr. Bunt acknowledges that there must come a day when the Australian Institute of Marine Science calls it a day with respect to mangrove research. But that time is at least 5 years in the future.